It's not about the reward. The reward is the process. Once you understand that, the reward, the money, the belt buckles, the medals, everything comes easier. Welcome to another edition of the Brian Kane Peak Performance Podcast. Today, our guest, Eric Burns, was one of the most electrifying players of his time in Major League Baseball. His all-out, all-the-time approach made him a fan favorite and a player whose hustle, drive, effort, and energy was emulated by high school and college players and programs all over the country. A 2013 inductee to the UCLA Hall of Fame, Burns always brings the juice.
Bring the juice!
Whether it's playing in the outfield for the Diamondbacks, A's, Orioles, Rockies, or Mariners, working as an analyst for Major League Baseball Network, or in his endurance race career, having completed 8 Ironman triathlons, will be his 9th in 2 days from now, and the Western States 100-mile mountain race. Be on the lookout for a documentary about his journey into the world of extreme races called From the Diamond to the Rough, which follows him through the Western States 100. You can learn more about Eric at burns22.com. That's BYRNES22.com. And on Twitter at burns22. Please welcome to the Peak Performance Podcast, Eric Burns. Eric, thanks for joining us, man.
I need some more Brian Kane in my life.
Well, thanks.
Can I get that intro every morning when I wake up out of bed and just get ready to charge?
Yeah, we'll create that as an alarm that you can play. Right now, mine pops up and says, "Where's the beef jerky?" as a tribute to Jocko Willink. But we can get that to pop up and play for you. Eric, if you would, man, give us kind of your journey from St. Francis High School, Northern California, to where you are today now.
Well, it's pretty simple, but basically I went to, grew up in Patola Valley, which is a small town in Northern California, which is, I'd say, probably more known for a lot of the pioneers of the Silicon Valley either grew up there or at least settled there in Patola Valley, Woodside area. So baseball or even sports in general wasn't very popular. But I had this like dream and vision of when I was a kid of doing two things. And one of them was playing professional sports, and the other one was talking about professional sports. And I used to sit around with my buddies, and we would just debate whatever, right? I mean, football, baseball, basketball, tennis, it didn't matter. Like, whatever it was, we were so passionate about it, and we just let it eat. And we fed off of sports talk radio. That was something that was, oh, KMBR 680, the sports leader, was it for us. And anyway, long story longer here, I ended up going to St. Francis, which was kind of a leap of faith for me because kids from my area, there weren't a lot that went to St. Francis, which was known back then as the premier sports school, really in the Bay Area. Now, they had De La Salle across the bay. You had Serra, which is where Barry Bonds went, Jim Fregosi, Lynn Swan, Tom Brady. And then Bellarmine was also a good one. But St. Francis, you know, arguably was the best of the best when it kind of came to all-around sports. So I ended up going there, played football my freshman year. Just at the time, just think about this. Like, you're a freshman in high school. I don't even think I'd gone through puberty yet. And I'm just trying to kind of make my way. I'm in this school with, I think there was one other kid from my grade school that went there. All these other guys had played Pop Warner. They were all friends and whatnot. And it was just, it was really kind of a lonely place and just kind of trying to find my way. And athletically, I'd never seen anything like in my life. Everybody were good athletes. So after the football season, I had to make a decision of whether or not I was going to play basketball. And I realized that, man, like, if I have any chance of, like, you know, being good here, I for the first time in my life, I'm like, I need to focus, kind of narrow my focus a little bit. And the decision I made, because basketball ran well into baseball season, was, hey, look, I'm not going to play hoops, which my claim to fame, and still to this day, probably my greatest athletic feat, was scoring 56 points in an 8th grade basketball game. Not kidding you. I worked with Tom Tolbert at KMBR, 6'8", who played in the NBA for like 7-8 years. And I always would give Tolbert crap because he had never scored 56 in a game. But anyway, I ended up going, went to the tryouts, right? Think about this. I just told the story of St. Francis the other night when I went back and showed the documentary Diamond to the Rough. Yeah. But there were 50 kids, 50, going out for a baseball team for 15 spots. Think about that.
This is a freshman.
This is high school freshman baseball. There's 50 kids. You know what our tryouts were? Play catch for 5 minutes. When you get done playing catch, we're going to take half of you. We're going to put you in the outfield. You're going to catch, I think it was maybe one or two fly balls. Then we're going to put you in the infield. Maybe it was four or five grounders. And that was it. Backed up with a pitching machine that was spitting balls out in every which direction. And you get five swings. And then after that, it was like, it's okay. I went in the outfield. I think I clanked one of the balls that I was supposed to catch. I go to the infield, booted a ball or two. I was just so nervous. And then I get to take a couple swings off the pitching machine, foul a couple off, swing and miss, pop a ball up, pop another one up. All right, Eric, thanks for coming out, and we'll see you. The results will be posted tomorrow in the gym. So I went to the gym the next day, and I just knew. I'm like, I didn't make it. There's no way. How could I possibly have made the team? And I told my mom, I said, look, I said, I'm almost positive that I'm going to get cut from this team. I can't take this. Like, I want to go to Woodside High School. Like, I'm transferring. Like, it's just too much for me. It was too overwhelming. The competition was too good. And the opportunity was too scarce. I mean, a lot of life is having opportunity, yeah. Right? If you don't have the opportunity to prove yourself. So I went there the next day and posted on the outside gym wall was all the names of the guys that made it. So I'm looking, everyone's kind of huddled around, and I'm looking from a distance. It's like, you know, Ryan, Brendan, Brian, Matt, all the way down to the bottom. 15 named Chris was the last name, no Eric. I said, all right. I said, this is cool. I prepared myself for this. I'm going to Woodside High School, no problem. But guess what? I'm going to look at every one of these 15 guys, and I'm going to mark them. And I'm going to go out and prove that there is not one of these guys that was a better baseball player than I am. And I went back and just kind of look at the names and scouted the names to make sure exactly who the guys were. And I get the last name. It was Chris Burns, B-Y-R-N-E-S. I'm like, Chris Burns? Like, no way there's another Burns here. Like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, did he screw up the first name? Did he screw up the last name? What's going on? So I went sprinting after the freshman baseball coach as he was walking away. And I'm like, Coach Ferreira! Coach Ferreira! Turns around and he goes, what can I do for you, Chris? I go, nothing. I'll see you at practice. That was it. That's all I needed to know. And so I went from thinking that I was getting cut from the freshman baseball team and having to transfer schools to obviously making the team. And
that's outstanding.
Career kind of took off from there.
Wow, how about that? So you go from making it as Chris Burns, right? And that's if the freshman team, then you end up going, you get drafted out of high school, mm-hmm. right? So obviously had a good career at St. Francis, and then made the decision to not sign pro with the LA Dodgers, but go on to UCLA. Well, you know, a lot of players that are listening to this, or parents or coaches that are listening to this, you know, there's always that debate, right? Of if you're a high school kid, do you sign and go and start your pro baseball career and get those extra 3 years of minor league baseball under your belt, or do you go to college? And you know, depending who you talk to, you're going to get a different answer. Sometimes it's a dollar figure amount. Other times it's a life experience amount and an education reason. Why did you choose to go to UCLA instead of signing pro baseball straight out of St. Francis High School?
Well, I think it's pretty simple. First of all, you know, for people listening to this, and I imagine a lot of the people that would actually listen are, you know, young guys that trying to find your way. I can't tell you how important the mental sort of side of baseball is, right? And what that did for me. But I just think that, you know, my parents instilled in me at a very young age what the most important thing in the world was, is, you know, family first and then education. And I knew I had a dream of wanting to play professional sports, but I also knew that there was going to be a time and place for it. And my belief in myself and my confidence in myself, and this is sort of where the mental game kind of really comes in, is that you got to be willing to walk. You got to have this ultimate belief in yourself that this is not going to be, you know what? I was a 38th round draft pick out of high school. A 38th round draft pick? I should have been a first round draft pick, right? Then I got drafted again in the fourth round by the Houston Astros after my junior year, where a lot of people would sign. And I met with the scouting director of the Houston Astros at the time, and he had come back to Cape Cod to watch me play for a week. And after the week, he's like, "Hey, Eric, I'd like to take you to breakfast, and you know, we're trying to negotiate a contract." And the average of the round back then was like $150,000, right? And so they had made an original offer of $90,000, which is just nowhere even near the average of the round. And their excuse was that they'd given their, you know, too much of the money to Lance Berkman, who they had drafted in the first round. Great choice and great guy to give a lot of money to, right? But it apparently had affected their second, third, and fourth round draft picks. And, you know, ironically, none of us ended up signing. But here was my thing. It wasn't about the money. I knew that $90,000, and then you pay taxes on a bonus, which is, what, $45,000? Even if it was $150,000, you told me I'm going to walk away with $75,000? I'll go blow $75,000 in a weekend, man. Like, that wasn't going to change my life. I understood that, and I knew that. What I wanted was an organization that believed in me, that said, hey, Eric, look, we're going to give you every opportunity to succeed. That's what I needed. And sure enough, we went to breakfast, and it was the scouting director and one other guy. And they sat there, and they said, hey, look, here's the deal. Give all our money to Berkman. We've watched you play for a week now. We think you're a circus act in the outfield. You pull the baseball way too much. You can't hit the ball the other way. You're fast, but you run funny and really awkward. So here's our $90,000 offer, and take it or leave it at this point. But it goes off the table tomorrow. I'm like, wow.
That's what they said.
I said, so hold on. Let me get this straight. I said, you guys are telling me that you're gonna basically offer me, you know, way less than the average of the round. And then on top of that, I said, hold on, guys, this isn't about the money. I said, right? I said, so what do you want me to do? I said, you want me to sign with an organization that already doesn't believe in me for a minimal value of the round, and I'm going to start with my back against the wall, knowing, you know, your guys' feelings, you know, about my game. I'm like, I just don't – where – in the manual of being a scouting director, when you're trying to sign a player, does it say, let's go ridicule him and demean him, and then obviously monetarily show him we don't have any support for him either, and think that that person would sign? You guys can go yourself. Got up and walked out.
Nice.
And that was it. That was the last time I ever spoke to the Houston Astros.
So you go back to UCLA for your senior year, and then go on and get drafted and make your way up to the big leagues. And, you know, talk a little bit about kind of that mental game or that belief that you had in yourself. Or let me slow down here. I'm all jacked up. What is the mental game to you, Eric? What's the mental game of baseball, man?
Confidence, belief in yourself. It kind of goes back to the story that I just told. Like, I don't respond the way I did without the confidence and without the belief in myself. Even going back to my freshman year, you know, I don't go back freshman year of college, high school, that is, and having that, I'll walk. I'll transfer schools. I need an opportunity. I need to play, right? I'm going to be a professional baseball player. And I didn't tell a lot of people. I told my mom. That was it. Kept it really low. It wasn't like I was, you know, parading around with a megaphone to all my friends. But when I was 13 years old, my dad used to throw me batting practice all the time and knew nothing about baseball. Absolutely zero. He was a 4-3 black belt in Kenpo karate. And he'd take me out and we'd go to town center in Patola Valley and he'd just throw BP days and days and days. I mean, just all day. And eventually when I was 13, it was like, there's only so much BP he could throw me. And my parents are like, hey, we got you a, they thought they were all clever, but they're like, we got you a birthday present. His name's Mike. And I'm like, what do you mean his name's Mike? We got you a new friend for your birthday. They're like, Mike. I'm like, what? Iron Mike.
Oh, yeah.
So down below where we lived, our house, the way it was situated, was kind of up on a hill. And then down below is a part of the property you couldn't really see, was a batting cage with an Iron Mike machine. When I was 13 years old, I cranked that thing up to 90 miles per hour. Throw as fast as it could throw. And, you know, at first, it had a tough time. Foul balls off, foul balls off, foul balls off. And eventually, I was raking it, right? Bam, 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 bam. Well, guess what? When I got to face, I was a sophomore in high school. I just got called up to varsity. I didn't start with varsity when I was a sophomore. I got called up to varsity to face Dan Serafini. Dan Serafini was a first-round pick out of Sarah. He threw 92 miles per hour from the left side. Nasty little sink. And there were 50 scouts in the stands, maybe more. And I went there to face him. And everyone else, they hadn't really seen it before, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, no problem. Whack, whack, whack. Three bullets off of Dan Serafini. And barely anyone else was touching him. It's repetition.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It is a skill that was developed through hard work. I even during football season, played football through high school, but even during football season, before school in the morning, just go bang, you know, 50 balls before I went to school. Got home at night, sun's going down, dark, whatever, pull out a few lights we put up in the cage, boom, just 50 more. Didn't overdo it.
Yeah.
Right? I just loved to hit. Well, guess what? Guess what that created? Confidence. So when I got there against Dan Serafini as a sophomore in high school, still not sure if I'm barely going through puberty at this point, and I'm hitting bullets off of 92 mile per hour fastballs when no one else is touching them, and now you have 50 scouts in the stands going, huh, who's this kid, right? And I think people need to remember, when it comes to the mental game, confidence is created and developed through work. So it's like a test. Imagine studying for a test, right? And you know those tests, right? I went into several where I wasn't prepared for the test. And what sort of confidence did I have going into that test? So long as I did my work and I studied for that test and I was ready for that test, I was confident. My mental game was exactly where it needed to be. Just like it's the same thing with the process of going up and playing in the big leagues. It's like people are, hey, are you nervous? Yeah, of course you're going to be nervous. It's just natural nerves. But guess what? Were you scared? Not one bit. I prepared myself for that day. Prepared myself.
So you've done 8 Ironmans. You're doing your 9th here in 2 days. What's the prep? Is it the same thing with going in and doing an endurance race, whether it's the 100-mile race or an Ironman where you've got... You've done the preparation. You've done the training with the run, bike, swim. So is it the same thing with the preparation in terms of you having done the work to go prepare for an Ironman triathlon?
Exact same thing. It's not any different. There is no natural transition from playing professional baseball to going into the endurance world. Like physically, there's very little translation between the two. But psychologically, very similar because it's all about doing the work and doing the work that gives you the confidence to go out there and have your best race on that given day. That's it. It's as simple as that. And that's what drives me, I think, in the training. Is part of it is that fear of knowing that test is there. That test is coming up. It's what eventually got me going in school. Is I knew that in order to go to a good college, like I was going to have to do the work to do well on my test to get me into a good school. And it all kind of became part of the plan. So ironically, as I got older, I became a much better student than I ever was at a younger age.
Talk about being a student for a second. One of the things you mentioned earlier off the air was how there was a time in your life where you just kind of were devouring books and you had a group of guys where you would go through Heads Up Baseball and then talk about that. Talk a little bit about the importance of leaders being readers, and for the people that are following this, what are some of the best books that you like to read?
Wow, yeah. One of the first books I really dove into and read probably 50 times over through the course of my entire baseball career was The Mental Game of Baseball by Carl Keel and Harvey Dorfman. Carl ended up being a mentor of mine when I played with the Oakland A's, and then even after, he was with the Indians at the time, and I was with the Arizona Diamondbacks, but we would have a weekly call that we had scheduled, and we would schedule at different times on different weeks, but man, like it was so incredibly beneficial having somebody there to sort of bounce some ideas off. I mean, it's funny because sometimes when I was rolling, we wouldn't even talk about baseball, and I sort of let him dictate the conversations. Mm. But ironically, I had there was no coincidence that I had my two greatest years in the big leagues when I was checking in with Carl on a weekly basis. And unfortunately, at the end of 08, I think is when he got sick and he ended up passing away. It hit hard and hit fast, and I still miss him dearly to this day. But the lessons that he taught me in my life and my career, just invaluable. So the other one, The Heads Up Baseball by Ken Revisa, is another one that I dove into with Scott Seal, a buddy of mine that we were roommates at UCLA, and then he ended up transferring to Fullerton and played there, and we got into pro ball at the same time. But during the off season, we just train together, live together, and we'd go through books, and it's specific to baseball. We would read the hitting books, be it the Charlie Lau's book or Ted Williams' book. It was funny because the one thing I think that I always did a good job at was digesting the language that spoke to me, because not everything's going to speak to you. So you have to be able to throw out a lot of what you hear in this game, but digest some really the key things. Since then, as far as books, man, like I don't know where to start. One of the latest ones that I would recommend everybody read, and it's going to be multiple. You'll have to read it multiple times. And the great thing about books now too, in because of all the training that I do, I go all just about all audiobooks.
Yep.
But Ralph Waldo Emerson's essay, Self-Reliance, is something that I could dig into every single day. The overall message of making decisions on your own and not necessarily conforming to societal norms. It's also not saying being an anarchist, right? But it's an incredible message. There's so much to take in, but I think it parallels, and it was written however long ago. But these parallels are incredible and it's amazing how relevant it still is. The Scholar was the latest one that I read of his, but I can't get enough of Emerson. It's amazing to me how relevant that Emerson and his writings still are to this day.
I just started reading a book about Stoicism, and it goes back to like Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus and these guys who were writing back in ancient Greece, the book is called The Daily Stoic by Ryan Holiday. It's awesome. It's a one-page day read, very short, and they're talking about Stoic. We think of Stoic as somebody who's non-emotional, right, and somebody who's just kind of there. And their idea of Stoicism is somebody who's so in control of themselves that they never let their emotions get the best of them, that they have the self-control, that they quickly identify what they can control, what they can't control, and they only focus their time, energy, attention on things they can control, which is a lot of what I learned through Heads Up Baseball and Revisa, but didn't realize it goes all the way back to the freaking Greeks, It's a long, and it's written in a language that you can tell it's ancient time. But the Ryan Holiday does a great job of translating that to make it sense for what you're doing today. It's pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Well, check it out.
Yeah. Ryan Holiday, it's The Daily Stoic.
Are you looking for a high-energy, competitive way to get your team to compete while training athleticism, hand-eye coordination, and lateral quickness? If so, you got to check out Spikeball. Top high school, college, and professional athletes around the world are using Spikeball as a fun and safe competition to start their training sessions, practices, and workouts. It's also a tremendous way to train your routines and releases and build that elite mindset. As a listener to the Peak Performance Podcast, you can get a free Spikeball set by visiting briankane.com/spikeball. Again, that's briankane.com/spikeball, because if you're not playing Spikeball, you're just playing games.
Other pieces of the mental game, you talked about kind of the confidence that comes from preparation. What about routines? What are some of the routines that you had to help you go one pitch at a time, Eric?
I was very routine oriented. I would, before just preparing for a game, I had my whole routine of, stretching that I would do. We're talking, let's just say, 35 minutes before the game, where it was the stretching to the sprints, to jumping over the laundry basket in the clubhouse. I did not go outside to sprint. I think, man, hardly ever in my big league career, because what happened is, as you start playing and all your peers, and you're seeing all your peers there, it's what you see today, which is, I don't know if it's BS or not. It depends, which side of the fence you're on when it comes to fraternization. But you see a bunch of guys playing grab ass out in the outfield. Well, I was there to play baseball and prepare myself for a game. I don't need to catch up with this guy and see how, the family's doing and everything else. And the guy on the other team, I wasn't interested in that. And so I felt like that was always a distraction to me. So I would actually do my sprints underneath in the tunnel, in the batting cage, so long as it was available. And then I would jump over laundry baskets too. And I had a whole routine of doing that. And then it was, I would hit off the tee, and it would just be, five balls the other, five balls the other way, pull five balls, finish with five balls up the middle. And then I'd throw too. So I just grab some balls in the cage and I'd throw 10, 15 balls, whatever I felt like. And then I'd make sure I finish about 5 minutes before the game. So I still had that, all right, physically I know I'm ready. Mentally, let's get here. Let's do it.
Awesome. Mental imagery, anything you used at all in terms of visualizing yourself playing well? Maybe it was something you do at night before you go to bed, or during the day when you're at the stadium, kind of visualizing yourself taking out bats off of the guy who's going to be pitching to you that day?
All the time. Every single day. That was another part of my routine that I would do. I guess I would do it after the tee work. But I would mentally have a vision of that pitcher, right? That we were going to face that day. And I would start with, I'd start with fastball. I'd go fastball away, ball, fastball away, strike, boom. So I'd, right, imagine fastball away, you're just taking it, nice soft take, ball, fastball away, strike, bam, shooting it the other way. Fastball middle, down or up, we're at a ball. Okay, fastball right there, boom. I just imagine low line drives. Fastball in, ball, fastball in, boom, drop the head, homer. Same thing, curveball down and away, ball, curveball outside corner, boom, base hit right field. Curveball middle, down in the dirt, good take. Next one, curveball middle, boom, base hit up the middle. Curveball inside, take it, curveball inside, homer. Same thing with the changeup. And I would do that every single day. It started, there's actually, here's another book I'd recommend. I'm trying to think, I want to say The Mental Game of Tennis, but that's not what.
Inner Game of Tennis.
Inner Game of Tennis. Yeah. So The Inner Game of Tennis is like one of the first mental books that I read. And when I was a kid, I was a big time tennis player. And you want to talk about, you think baseball players have stress? Like that tennis game, and especially at a young age, and you're on that island by yourself, that's heavy. So through the Inner Game of Tennis, like I learned like the whole the importance of the visualization. So I would play the match the night before, and I would go sit in this chair and in our living room, and you know, my mom would, she'd always help me with it and stuff, and she was just like, all right, just go ahead and you know, visualize your match. Well, I was playing against these ridiculously good tennis players. There was like, geez, Michael Jessup, Corey Guy, Misha Palacek, Ryan Walters. All four of these dudes went on. Palacek, Walters, and Jessup were like 1, 2, 3 at Stanford. Corey Guy was the number one player at Santa Barbara. All of them went on to play professional tennis in some capacity. And you know, these were like a lot of the guys that, man, I was competing against these dudes, right? And it was just, it was super heavy, and we, you know, a lot of traveling or whatever. But that's where I learned the mental side, and then I slowly transitioned that. I'm like, okay, if I can envision playing these matches, why can't I envision, you know, what the game's gonna look like tomorrow in baseball, what my at bats are gonna look like? And so I started doing that. And then I truly believe that's where my baseball career sort of took off in a sense when I was about 12, and you know, in All-Stars and going through that mental imagery of doing it. Because again, when you stand in the box, what did I say, like, you know, what is the mental game? That game is confidence and belief, right? But what gives you confidence and belief is the fact that you've done the work. Well, guess what? When I got that box, I'd already been there. Mm-hmm. I'd already done it. Mm-hmm. I'm comfortable. I've seen it.
Did you do the same thing when you're getting ready to run the do an Ironman? Do you see yourself crossing the finish line already and all that? Now that you've already done 8, but when you go back to doing your first one, was it the same process, seeing yourself crossing the finish line and all that?
I did it yesterday.
Yeah.
Sitting in the float tank. The float tank's just tank filled with, you know, whatever. Now it's, I like putting myself in positions. When I could find that quiet time. Went through the whole race. Went through the beginning. What's it gonna be like jumping in? And yeah, I don't care how many you do. The best never stop preparing. It's not like, you know, if I didn't have a little anxiousness and a little fear, and like that's normal, man. Like, you want that. That's why I do these. If I lose that, you know, it's not gonna have the same luster. And am I more comfortable because I have 8 under my belt? Of course I am. Of course I am. But I also still know that in order to get my best result, I need to go out there and run through this. What's it going to be like? There's going to be a lot of contact in the swim. You know, imagine and visualize and even feel like for every stroke, I mean, I'm going to come down and I might get hit. Or what's happening when the guy's grabbing on my legs behind me? Am I going to kick him off, or am I going to relax? I went through it, and then getting on the bike and visualizing the transition. Okay, what exactly do I need? You know, when I get out of the water... when I eventually get out of the water, I'm going to unzip the top of my wetsuit. I'm going to take my watch off. I'd like to keep it clean, because if you pulling it over the watch and the thing's stopping, everything, boom, watch off, wetsuit, top off. But I'm going to keep everything on, waist down. And they have wetsuit strippers there that actually will take the whole thing off. But I want to keep mine on, because I'm going to have some little booties. I'm gonna get a good run to grab my transition bag, get in the transition where I'll have my helmet, short little socks, and my bike shoes ready to go. But guess what? I'll have a towel laid out too. I'll have a towel in there so I can take the booties off without getting grass all over my feet. So when I put on my socks, right, there's not gonna be grass sitting there for the next, you know, 9 hours or whatever it's gonna be. You know, all of that is, yeah, all of that's prepared for. All of that's thought of. You know, bike computer is going to be on the bike. I mean, there's so much. You know, make the nutrition, make sure, you know, making sure the nutrition and the bottles are lined up. You need to be very meticulous about that. And then I visualize the bike. I mean, ideally in the first loop of the bike that we have tomorrow, I want to control my effort. And I've had a tendency to go out and guns blazing and then progressively each lap gets slower. It usually happens anyway, but I'm going to try to ride as consistently as possible through the entire 112 miles, which then I believe will allow me to have my best run, and ideally my best run I've ever had in an Ironman. So It should be fun.
Yeah, sounds like you're and I, you know, having viewed your documentary from the Diamond to the Rough, which is unbelievable. Anybody listening to this has got to check that out, From Diamond to the Rough. So if you can let them know where they can get that, that'd be great. And in that, you talk a lot about the joy is in the process. What does that mean?
Well, you know, the reward. Everyone talks. Everyone always. I mean, we like the reward, don't we? Like the reward is one of the reasons why we do what we do in any industry. It's your payday. Mm-hmm. It's making your money. In the endurance world, it's a medal at the end of an Ironman. It's a belt buckle at the end of the Western States 100 mile endurance run. That's the reward. You know, for my kids, you know, they love it. And it's the trophy, and they're out there and they're playing. It's a trophy, and right? And so when we're kids, I don't think we know the reward's there, and we think we're chasing the reward. And then when you're in baseball and you're playing baseball and you think you're chasing the money and everything, and then I got into endurance sports and it was like I thought I was chasing the medal and the fact that I could say, oh, I've done 8 Ironmans and everything else. And I think it really hit me when I did the Western States 100. That it's not about the reward. The reward is the process. And I think that once you understand that, the reward, the money, the belt buckles, the medals, everything comes easier. But that's simply a result of you fully embracing the process. So, going forward here, man, like, I just did an article yesterday. I talked to Susan Slusser from the San Francisco Chronicle, and they're going to do a big story about Diamond to the Rough. And it's interesting because when I was explaining that to her, and every time I explain it, as I explain it to you today, like, it rings so true. Yet I think sometimes, you know, through the course of your life, like, you don't get it and you don't understand it, but guess what? It hasn't changed. It hasn't changed since you were 9 years old and you're running around a little league field or you're running around a soccer field or anything else. We thought we were chasing the trophy, but we weren't chasing the trophy. Like, the absolute reason why we do it is because of the exhilarating emotional feelings that we get from being out there, being out on the race course, being on the baseball field. That's what life's about. That's living. That's it.
In the you know, when you cross the finish line of those Ironmans or of the you know, Western States 100, you carry a jersey of a former Arizona State football player, Pat Tillman. Could you talk a little bit about your relationship with Pat and then why you carry that jersey, why that's so important to you?
Well, Pat played for, he went to Leland High School in San Jose, same time I went to St. Francis, and we would watch him, I'm not kidding you, and we would gawk. From his junior year, senior, like, it was just like, is this guy for real? He was an undersized dude that just, I mean, he was blowing dudes up on defense. He was giving him the football and just, he was running around guys, he was running over guys. It was like, how often is it that you get a group of high school kids in you know, this totally uncomfortable state in your life, you know, with all this testosterone and macho bravado and everything else, where you could get a group of high school kids that were playing on the best high school football team in the area, and we'd look at a guy on this other team and go, that dude's the baddest dude I've ever seen. He'd have the blonde locks flowing out of his helmet. And so, basically what happened is, I think the first time we met was, we saw him at a Leland St. Francis volleyball game. And a buddy of ours, like, we were scared to go up to him. And we're like, dude, that's Tillman over there. And so a buddy of ours by the name of Zach Walls is like, I gotta go, I gotta do it. And he went up, walked across the gym. It's like, hey, Pat, you know, Zach Walls, I go to St. Francis, football player, just want to meet you and say how much we respect you and like this and that. And that was pretty cool to see because just like 4 or 5 years later, Zach Walls was the 6th round draft pick of the Arizona Cardinals after going to Dartmouth and playing for 4 years. And Pat Tillman was the 7th round draft pick of the Arizona Cardinals after going to ASU and playing for 4 years. And then they roomed together with the Cardinals here in '98 when I first signed with the A's. And I'd come and just like, man, do anything to hang around the you know, I'm low-level minor leagues, the bottom barrel in instructional league, and I'm hanging around some NFLers in Pat and Zach. And, you know, my time actually getting to know Pat was very limited. I spent very little time with him, hanging out with him. The times that I did, you could tell there was something just special about him. And then he ended up, obviously after 9/11, deciding to walk from football and join the Army Rangers. And from there, I wanted to do the same thing. And I was just like everybody else that, you know, was emotionally moved by 9/11 terrorist attacks. And it was, you know, we wanted to fight, man. And you know, Pat did an interview. He's like, you know, what have I done? Yeah, yeah, yeah. So my great-grandfather fought in World War One. My grandfather fought in World War Two. My dad fought in Vietnam. Like, he going through it, right? He's like, what the hell have I done?
My great-grandfather was at Pearl Harbor, and a lot of my family has given up, you know, has gone and fought in wars, and I really haven't done a damn thing as far as laying myself on the line like that, and so I have a great deal of respect for those that have and what the flag stands for.
Right, and you could tell he was, this is the day after 9/11 when you did this interview, and I had the same feeling. I always had these visions, and you know, Mike Seal, who happens to be, you know, in the condo right now staying with me, but him and I, we always talked about being Navy SEALs. And that was always like our fascination. But guess what? Here I was, after 9/11, just busting into the big leagues. And was I willing to give it all up to go to Afghanistan and fight for our country? I wasn't. I didn't have the balls to do it. And you know what? Pat did. And, you know, it's a shame of how it ended because it didn't have to. And you know, the whole thing with the friendly fire and the cover up and everything else was disgusting. But in no way does it diminish the sacrifice that he was willing to make for the sake of your ass and mine. And, you know, ten years ago now, in 2006, when I was with the Diamondbacks, I got a call from Richard Tillman, Pat's youngest brother, and he knew I'd always, you know, talked well about Pat and pumped Pat up, and he knew how close Zach and I were, and he invited me out to the statue unveiling out at the new stadium in Glendale, and there was a group of only about 50 of like family members and friends for this statue unveiling, and I was fortunate enough to be there and watch it and really, you know, got close with the family, Marie, his widow. Kevin, his brother, who he went to Afghanistan with, who also was an Army Ranger, Richard, and a couple of his best friends, this guy Ben Hill and Alex Garwood, and who were running the foundation at the time. And I basically, at that point, knew that I was all in with doing whatever I could do to make sure that the next generation of kids knew exactly who Pat Tillman was and the sacrifice that he made. So, you know, it's not to diminish sacrifices of other people and other 18-year-old kids that are signing up around the country to go serve our country. But there is something to say when you don't have to go and, you know, you're at the height of your NFL career and you have a multi-million dollar offer on the table and you walk. That was something special, and I just want to continue to celebrate that and celebrate the foundation, which has gone on to do some really, really good things with education, in providing scholarships for military members and their families, and basically grooming these people to be game changers in society, which is exactly what Pat was.
It's awesome. I had the privilege to run the Pat Tillman race one time at Arizona State, you know, and for people that are listening to this, it's a short 5K race, you know, but there's probably 25,000-30,000 people that show up at Arizona State Sun Devil Stadium for that race. They do every year. And if you're looking for something to get you going and something to remind you of that we live in the greatest country in the world, show up for that race. It's unbelievable. And walk it or do it, but it's something that you've got to do. If you're listening to this podcast, go online right now and Google Pat Tillman Race, Arizona State University. Find out when it is and go smash it. Go do it, because you're gonna get a lot out of that experience and that opportunity. Eric, last question for you here, man. I really appreciate your time today. It's been fantastic. One of the most fun podcasts we've ever done. 40 years old, 8 Ironmans in, Major League Baseball career, been an analyst. You got a book that you've written that's going to be coming out that I can't wait to read. It's going to be off the charts. You got a documentary. You're married. You've got children. How do you define success for you right now? In baseball, it's easy. It's a statistical thing, right? Everybody can determine if you have success based off of numbers. How do you define success in your life right now?
A successful person, and I feel like I'm having success, and I say I'm winning. I'm not sure if that's the right word, but when I'm able to embrace the moment. And we don't live in the moment today. Like, it's very difficult sometimes, right? And we're so consumed with social media, and we want everything quick and we want everything fast, and it's the millennial generation, and I get it, man. I live this fast-paced life. I have a lot of things going on. But you know, you mentioned that, you know, I have 3 kids. I have a 5, 6, and 7-year-old. You know, married. I do everything I can to be a good father, a good husband. And then I have a job that is 3,000 miles away. So I live in California, at Half Moon Bay, about 20 miles south of San Francisco. But I have a place in New York City, in MLB Networks in Secaucus, New Jersey, right across the river, about 15 minutes away. And it's my life is constantly in flux. And we have a place in Tahoe as well that we're about to go up to after this and spend just about all the winter there. You mentioned the documentary, so that's been a lot in dealing with that and going through the editing process and everything else. But not to mention the training that goes into the Ironman races and the 100-mile run. But what I've learned through all of it is that you can only be one place at one time. So if we're sitting here and doing the podcast, like, I need to be here. Like, I can't worry about these 15 other things going on. And I've noticed that I have the most success in my life when I'm able to bring it to the now. And that is, I think that's what matters, is to embrace the moment. It's as simple as that. As simple as that.
Awesome. Eric Burns, you are off the podcast hot seat, my friend. Fantastic. Again, you can get more Eric Burns at burns22.com and on Twitter, Burns, that's B-Y-R-N-E-S, 22 on Twitter. Eric, thank you for your time, man. You were off the charts. Thank
right,
you.
Thanks, buddy. Hey, dude, one last thing, though, yeah. For the film.
Yes, the documentary. Yes.
Hey, this is not a monetary play for me. I'm not doing this to make money off this thing. There's a special message in there that is very family oriented. One of the things that Susan Celeste, when she was doing the article yesterday, she's like, I just was like amazed by the doc. Like, I just kind of figured it was going to be like this other this athlete vanity piece, right? And it's anything but that. So if there's one thing that I would recommend to people, go to Vimeo.com. Right. It's Vimeo.com/on-demand/diamond-to-the-rough.
And can you give that one more time?
Yeah. Vimeo.
Yep.
.com/on-demand/diamond-to-the-rough. watch this documentary. And I think it just, it hits so many different people on so many different levels. That the only thing I care about on this is I want eyeballs to see it.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. This is not a monetary play one thing. This isn't an ego thing or anything else. There's a message within that documentary, I think, that will resonate with a lot of people. And it could help change somebody's life.
What's the message, Eric, that you want people to get from the documentary?
It's about the process. It's not about the reward. And it's about embracing everything that's important in your life that helps you enjoy that process. It's about family. It's about giving your kids every opportunity to succeed. It's about setting an example for your children and influencing them and not force feeding them anything, but allowing them to make their own decisions. But guess what? You have a 100% responsibility to set that example for them, lead them to the right direction, and let them find their own path. And then one of the main ones is you always need to have an idea of what's next, and find what's next, and find your happiness, find your zone, find something that is going to motivate you each and every single day. And I think really the last one is do something physical that will help, because if we get out and do something physical, it doesn't have to be a 100-mile run, not even close. I don't care if it's walking around the block twice. Get outside, clear your mind, clear your head. Because as a kid that grew up with severe ADHD, I could tell you, even now, with all the information that's coming, I got a buddy of mine that he scans brains. He could show me a brain of an ADD kid without exercise indoors, and it looks like a tiny little penny. And imagine like 20 minutes of moderate exercise after being outside, that ADD's kid's brain, it is lit up like a freaking giant pancake. We're not any different. Some people are more extreme. People with ADD are more extreme in what that can do for you. But this is something that the idea and thought that people are canceling pee is disgusting to me. The lack of physical activity amongst our youth is disturbing. But you know, again, the overall message is enjoy the process and embrace the moment.
I thought it was awesome that you're the career transition piece too. You know, I mean, as a pro athlete, it's all of a sudden, you know, you're the quote the guy says in there, which is, I think is beautiful. He says, "You're a dragon slayer, and now there's no dragons to go slay."
Yeah.
And whether you're an athlete, whether you are if you're in the military, you know, Marcus Luttrell said the same thing, that when his Navy SEAL days came to a close, that there were some dark times, you know, and he had to find out what's next, like the shirt that you're wearing in the documentary. And for him, it was taking a dry erase marker and writing down his goals on his bathroom mirror so he could see them. And he said that's kind of what got him going again, was seeing something, having a vision, having a tangible task that I'm going to go and attack. Whether it's preparing for a game, preparing for a seminar, preparing to go to combat, or preparing to wake up and make your kids breakfast. What's your task for the day that you're going to sign your name with excellence on and go out there and keep moving forward? And having worked in athletics, there's a lot of guys that when that career ends, man, there's some dark times, because everything you've always done, hitting a ball, running, diving, making a catch, that doesn't necessarily translate to what you're going to do now the rest of your life to be successful. However, who you became and who you needed to become to be successful as an athlete, that same process, that same mindset, that same drive, that same attention to detail will help you if you take that with you into what you do.
You know?
Right. So I was trying to figure out how to help guys who channel that. But
it's awesome, dude.
Eric, thanks, man. Brian. Appreciate you, man. That was absolutely outstanding. Thanks again.
Thanks for listening to the Peak Performance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please head over to iTunes and leave a positive review or share a link to this episode on social media using hashtag PeakPod. Mention Brian Kane and one thing you learned in this episode for your chance to win a free ticket to the next Brian Kane Experience live event. Dominate the day.